podcast about the monsters, spooks, and nasty guys that inhabit your favorite fantasy settings. We're your hosts.
Hi, I'm Noel, and I believe the best way to kill both malaria and mephits are with a gin and tonic.
Hi, I'm Colin, and if you want to be with me, you've got to rub me the right way.
And today we're talking about gin.
For our first wish, we'd like more additions.
But first, some news and updates.
Anything new going on? Anything special? I don't know if you guys caught, I'm not the biggest fan of Wizards of the Coast, Dungeons and Dragons, TM, whatever. they did officially, they made a tweet, this would have been around like a year or two ago. They basically put out this huge survey of just trying to see, basically it had a huge list of basically every setting, that's ever been put out for D&D, almost.
Right, right.
I want to say, like, maybe a handful got left off, and they had a write-in other option.
Yeah.
And basically, they like, you got 3 votes on the survey, and they basically just wanted to gauge, like, you know, what people would be most excited to see return.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the things that topped out that list, I mean, of course, like, Faerun went really high, but...
Well, yeah.
I mean, everyone knew that Faerun was going to be the main package thing. You know, it was going to be what the DM's Guild was based on, et cetera, et cetera.
Of course.
But, like, how high Ravenloft ranked was why we got Curse of Strahd so soon.
Yeah.
And stuff like that.
Yeah.
So a lot of people since then have kind of been like, you know, oh, when are we finally going to get a new setting? Because like Curse of Strahd technically wasn't so much a setting as a very expansive sandbox to drop into any game.
Yes.
And we haven't gotten, you know, Dragonlance is teased a lot in the Player's Handbook, but we still haven't gotten any Dragonlance information.
Nope.
Occasionally it'll be one of the things referenced, along with Dark Sun, like, in when you have like a big adventure book, it's obviously made to be slotted into a Forgotten Realms campaign.
Yes.
But there's always a heavy setting of just like, this is how you can fit it into these other settings you might be familiar with. And Dark Sun's always included. Dragonlance is always included. Sometimes Greyhawk, like old, like regular D&D is included. But I mean, that's basically the expense of it. But, so people were like, you know, oh, you know, when we get a new thing, I know we're getting a new player's option book. We're getting, updated Tomb of Horrors, et cetera, et cetera, but like no new setting. And finally they made an official like tweet, like just putting this out there that like, hey, yeah, like really we do, it might take a while, but we really do want to bring back all of the old settings, every setting that everyone loves. Like we want to bring those back and give people a way to like play them, give new players a way to experience it, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
But they made a point of saying one thing. They said even Spelljammer.
And I am excited.
I mean, we talk about Spelljammer a lot. We talked a lot about it on the Illithids episode.
Oh, yeah.
We talked a lot about it last episode.
Yep.
We're going to talk about a lot of it on this episode.
Oh, yes.
Man, Spelljammer and Planescape, what great settings.
I love them.
Yeah.
I love them dearly. Fucking fantasy space planets and Nautilus ships and
I mean it's the perfect link of my 2 favorite weird settings to bring into D&D games, and that's espionage spy thrillers and swashbuckling magical pirate adventures. Those 2 things combined together in a fantasy setting is just my weird slice of perfect.
I like both of these things.
Yeah. If you wanted a blue Jason Bourne to have to get into a knife fight with Johnny Depp with horns.
Yes.
And there you go.
That's the setting for you and me and you and everyone listening. Honestly,
yeah.
It's just a perfect setting.
Yeah, it's great and ridiculous. But anyways, speaking of calls for other stuff.
Yes.
This is, I guess, kind of weird to say, but
we're nearing the end.
Yeah, we don't want to keep making creature culture when we've kind of run out of things or heart to keep doing.
Right.
And you know, we this time last summer we went through a big shakeup, took a couple months off to get some more life out of the show. The whole like making a setting thing was fun.
Yeah.
And definitely I think there are a lot of good episodes that dealt with that, but I mean, short of turning this into a short fiction podcast,
yeah,
there's, you know, it doesn't really seem like people are super interested in that outside of, you know, fun little creative exercises, which are great.
And it's perfectly fine.
And we're definitely, we're running out of creatures with cultures.
To culture, yeah. There's only so much culture you can force on a slime.
Yeah. Good friend of the show, Roy, really, really wants us to do a unicorns episode. And, I mean, we could do we could talk about unicorns, but really, like, we can't make an episode out of unicorns.
Unicorns don't have culture.
I mean, like, there's two things that have unicorn culture in them. The Last Unicorn and My Little Pony. And I'm not going to watch The Last Unicorn.
And I'm not going to cover My Little Pony. That being said, I could probably get drunk enough to try.
I don't really like My Little Pony, but it's watchable. It's a good kid show.
As a children's show, taken that way, it's enjoyable.
Here's the thing to keep in mind. They're 15-minute episodes.
Exactly.
That's just like slap the vein, shoot them in.
Yeah.
Like, just get them in there, and you're fine. Like, whatever. An hour's passed, and your friendship is magic, man. Whatever.
Exactly. But that's not genies.
I mean, not even to get to genies yet, but, you know, we don't want to drag the show out. Right. We do have...
What is it, 4 or 5 left?
We've got probably about 3 months left. Okay. Because adding genocide to this, I think, takes us into November.
Okay.
But the big thing is we wanted to let you guys know this ahead of time.
Yes.
So that if there is a particular thing that you really, really, really want us to campaign, or you want to campaign for to get us to cover in the show, we would love to hear it.
Yes.
Yeah. Again, we'll say this at the end of the show. Our Twitters, emails, et cetera, et cetera. But please, if there's something that you really, really think that we should cover, let us know. If you want us to start a weird podcast after this where we cover regular-ass podcast or regular-ass races, please don't make us do that.
I don't wanna.
Yeah.
I don't wanna.
I know, I've been talking on Twitter about basically once creature culture is in the bag, basically, like, what I'm going to take that time and use it towards, and I've gotten some decent suggestions for stuff. We'll see where that goes.
Cool.
But yeah,
I got nothing. I'm a lazy sack of shit.
But creature culture, it's been a great show to do. We're going to keep, the next like several months that we're still doing it.
Because,
I mean, bi-monthly release schedule, like, great, wonderful, fun.
It's been perfect for us.
Yeah. Basically, right now, I think this is the last, race we haven't covered that we're covering.
I believe so.
Everything else on the docket we want to do are... covering things that we've only covered once. One of them we've covered multiple times. I'll leave you up to figure out what that is. And we do want to... We've got a close personal friend that really, really wants to pitch Iron Kingdoms to us. So we're going to have an Iron Kingdoms episode.
Why not?
Kind of want to do an Eberron episode. We'll have to read a lot for that.
Yeah, we will.
Yeah. But we'll see if that happens.
But it has the coolest country ever.
It does. Eberron is great. If there's literally anything that y'all want us to cover, please do. We could do, I know we said, things that it's kind of hard to make an episode of the Oozes. They don't really have a culture, but if if you guys have a big list of monsters you want us to talk about, we could do kind of like how we did with the Monster Musume episode. We could do a rapid fire, let's just talk about monsters episode.
Which I'm down for.
Yeah.
I'm always ready to talk about monsters. Sentient, non-sentient, doesn't matter. I am a living bestiary.
Yes. But that said, we're here to talk about Jin.
Yes.
Jennies, genies, genocide, et cetera,
starts with a J.
Yeah, and it's vaguely Middle Eastern inspired, we're going to talk about it.
Yes.
So, without a doubt,
What are Jin?
Okay, so Jin are... They're a race of supernatural people that are they're mostly associated with the religion of Islam,
right?
And that's mostly where they're referenced from. But that's mostly because they are kind of directly carried out of Middle Eastern folklore.
Yes.
There are a lot of theory. They're not related to Zoroastrianism, even though they do get conflated with that. But a big thing to remember in that is that. Persian culture and the rest of like the Middle East and Arabia and India often get conflated because Persia was the superpower for so long.
Right.
But really, after a certain point, you really can't connect those things anymore. Yeah. And really, jinn come out of just folk tradition, Zoroastrianism would have influence over sometimes, that Christianity would have influence over sometimes.
Yes.
But basically, according to the Quran, jinn were a race of people created by God, from smokeless, scorching fire.
Interesting.
They are, what you would read from an outside perspective, definitely, whereas humans are mundane, jinn are supernatural, but in the context of the Quran, they're just a separate variety of people.
Right, they're just supernatural humans, essentially.
Yeah, to the Quran, you have three sentient races. You have humans, angels, and jinn.
Yes.
The basically thing that separates angels is angels are the only ones that don't have free will. Angels are always good, except the fallen angels who are evil.
Yes.
Jinn and humans have full conscious morality. They can be good, they can be evil, they can be neutral, whatever.
Yes.
Usually they're described as, humans of various skin colors, often in, eccentric, rich garb. Sometimes, it's like a person's torso with just like a swirling cloud underneath them. So usually they can change forms into different things. Many times they're giant.
That is a fairly common theme within a lot of genie fiction, is them being very, very large.
Yeah, or them being able to change their size and shape. There's a lot of different kinds of jinn.
An exceptional amount, actually.
Yeah, there's a couple different traditions. The big main tradition separates them into five different kinds.
Right.
You have Marids, which are the most popular jinn. Or, not the most popular, the most powerful jinn.
Okay.
From then, you have Ifrits, which...
I know that name.
Yeah, they're just a lower class of jinn. They do get popularized because of Final Fantasy, of course. But while later things will attribute elemental associations to different kinds of jinn, I know in D&D, Marids and Ifrits are the water and fire jinn, basically. But those things don't exist. Like, they're all fire.
Exactly. Linked. In the traditional folklore, they are all fire folk.
Yeah. Then you have the Shaitans. Shaitans are further broken down. Shaitans are any evil jinn, basically, where if you're an evil jinn, you get clumped into this classification.
Yeah.
And then that classification is broken up into jinn who are simply non-believers in God.
Yes.
Jinn who are pagan deities.
Yes.
So all pagan deities are Shaitans. And then Satans. Satans, being jinn who are devils.
All right.
So, I believe, the Wikipedia for this lists, Iblis and, his kin. Hmm. A specific, pagan deity that gets called out is Pazuzu.
I know that name.
Yes.
He's the governor of Texas.
good shout out to the Demons episode. from there you have Jinn. Which the Jinn classification of Jinn is basically just the regular everyday Jinn.
Yes.
And then beneath them you have Jans.
Jinn and Jan.
Yeah. Jans are the weakest variety of Jinn. They're most associated with snakes, and people with snake forms.
Interesting.
They're being the weakest kind of Jinn, they get pretty jealous of the other Jinn being above them, especially the most powerful ones and how popular they are. And just sometimes a Jinn will just be like, everything's always about Marids, Marids, Marids. And, then they get hit in the face with a football and, the tiki things... god gets angered.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Laugh track. And...
I'm very sorry. I don't even really like the Brady Bunch all that much.
Everyone knows that line, though, so you're excused.
They do. Other varieties of classification traditions, they clump them into djinn that can turn into dogs or snakes, djinns that can turn into smoke, and just regular ass everyday djinn.
I thought they were smokeless.
But they can, they're often, can turn into like a cloud form. I don't know. It can be confusing sometimes.
As, you know, the supernatural does.
Yeah. But I mean, there's a lot of kind of things that you can look at. You can kind of compare this to the whole burning bush story.
Right.
Where, you know, Moses seeing a bush in flames not being consumed was weird, but it wasn't supernatural. What was supernatural was when he went up to that burning bush and saw the image of an angel and God inside of it.
Yeah, that makes it a little more powerful than the traditional, I saw a burning shrub.
And then what really sold it after seeing a man's inside of the burning shrub was when the man's turned his staff into a snake.
Yes.
So, you know, it really kind of drives home that, you know, djinn, while they definitely read as a fantastic element, are the in context are just to be considered normal. Like sometimes you go out in the desert and you meet a flaming man, and he's giant.
And he's just like, yo.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's it.
Yeah.
But sometimes there's no more to that story. You just meet a flaming man and he's like, hi, and you say hi and then you walk away.
Yeah. And usually they are considered wise and powerful. In Solomon's, what's the Solomon demonography thing? The Book of Solomon, yeah.
There we go.
Yeah, in the Book of Solomon, when Solomon describes his placement as king and the prophets sitting behind him in support of him, sitting behind the prophets in support of them were the djinn.
Yes.
And specifically, he talks about having contracted the djinn to build the Temple of Solomon.
Yes.
Which kind of starts tying into the whole... idea of djinn and genies, where genie is of course just an anglicized version of djinn, which is a romanized version of al djinn, which is an Arabic term for fire people.
Linguistics, folks.
Yeah, but genies are specifically kind of come from the 1001 Nights story. Mm-hmm. Which actually has multiple djinn in it, not all of which grant wishes.
Right.
But, you know, the whole idea of a genie where, you know, you free them or you have control of them and they can grant three wishes for you, et cetera, et cetera, kind of is tied up in this whole idea of binding some kind of powerful supernatural entity and having them do work for you.
Yes. I mean, you've got them imprisoned and then someone lets them go and they're going to be like, thanks, buddy. Yeah. I'm going to do some stuff.
Yeah.
Don't be a dick about it, though.
But any instance, it's not like any time that you find the genie, you know, oh, you found the genie. It's kind of like finding a leprechaun's pot of gold. They have to grant you a wish or a treasure or something.
Yeah.
It's no, just the popular story of 1001 Nights or Aladdin or however you want to refer to it is specifically there was a genie who with immense cosmic power, and he was bound inside a lamp. And anyone who released him from the lamp got three wishes from the genie.
Right. hey, you did a good thing. Thanks.
And, you know, genie, they get spread around all of basically everything.
Forever.
East of a certain point in Europe.
Yeah.
They do definitely, you see references to them in 1001 Nights, which is the big purveyor to the West for genies. That's where you see, like, Marid and Ifrit and djinn get used almost interchangeably for just a class of demon.
Yes. That's one thing even I've noticed.
Yeah.
Where it's always, you know, you can see them repeatedly, even in the same work, used as the same thing, but three different names.
Yeah. Which, honestly, is very, very common for Christian texts that are just kind of grabbing at, you know, oh, well, you know, let's throw in the word Orcus because this is vaguely death related.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's not overly concerned about the specifics, but as long as you get the idea, we're happy.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
And because it had such kind of far-reaching ideas, I mean, like, a lot of times the specific story of Aladdin and the lamp gets attributed as actually a Chinese folktale. That made it into 1001 Nights. Being that, you know, it was written a very cosmopolitan city that got a lot of, you know, different tales and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, these kind of influences, you can see them, like, all over Eastern culture. JRPGs have all kinds of... I mean, even leaving out, you know, Ifrit being a huge main staple of Final Fantasy. I mean, Ifrit is in so many different fucking RPGs. Genies, Djinn, Mephits, Merids, you know, all different kinds of different things.
Honestly, Japan seems to have a love affair with, you know, genies.
I mean, there's a lot of influences that Japan pulls from Arabic mythology, Indian mythology, Chinese mythology, a bunch of different stuff. Like, when you look at it in context of where all these different things are coming from, it's just that Japan has been exposed to a bunch of cultures that... Yeah. We as Westerners really weren't,
right?
Or if we were, it was
very filtered.
Yeah, the translation process to Chinese is a little bit more forgiving than the translation process to English.
Yeah,
if only because it was done, you know, not in a different time and a different context.
Also, they more than likely had more people who were willing to aid in that. You could get more viewpoints and more experience and more, you know, people. Because it's a difference in vicinity, I guess. Yeah.
And then also you have things that expose certain problematic issues with, you know, the fact that, you know, Japan is separated from these kinds of cultures, which things like Mr. Popo, let's make an Indian blackface for our genie character in Dragon Ball Z.
Yep. Dragon Ball did a lot of pretty okay references to genies. Mr. Popo was not one of them.
Yes. But I mean, plenty of other things kind of stuck with, looking at, especially Indian art, with the influence of, having narrative focus on, you know, blue and red skinned, individuals. Usually that's how they'll depict genies.
Right.
That's why, despite, genies having a very, very, or djinn having a very firm origin of being, beings created from smokeless fire.
Yes.
Once you start coloring them blue, it's really, really easy to forget that and make them heavily wind-themed.
Yes, which is a big, big common element.
Yeah, I mean, in Pokemon Black and White, you had the genie trio.
Yep, the Thundarus and all them.
Yeah, which were basically taking, classical... the Thunder and Lightning Oni and then jamming them together with genies.
Which was pretty cool.
Yeah, no, it was super cool.
Yeah, just really far away from their origin, that's all.
Yeah.
And then there were other ones that weren't even really elemental, like, you know, Hoopa, which is a genie of magical portals through space and time.
Yeah. We're basically just, you know, focusing on the cosmic power kind of thing.
Yes.
And of course, how most people were probably first exposed to genies, you have Aladdin, the Disney movie. Which, again, focuses more just on the magical power of genies.
Yes. And for that one, it sort of fits because he freed them from the lamp kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I liked it. I think everyone else did too.
Yeah. The genie of the lamp is supposed to be particularly powerful. I mean, you also have the 1940s film The Thief of Baghdad, which kind of follows a similar kind of story idea.
Right.
There is the genie of Baghdad, which protects Baghdad and is immensely powerful, but kind of, you know, forced to be subservient to the people or whatever.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, genies show up all the time. Dark Souls. What is the name of that game?
Dark Cloud?
Yeah, Dark Cloud is definitely a very difficult game, or at least it was difficult the last time I tried to play it.
It could be, yeah.
Yeah, probably the first time I had to do resource-like management in a game. Goddamn.
I love the City Builder, though.
Yeah, the City Builder was so good. I feel like nowadays I'd probably appreciate the roguelike elements of it a lot more. Like,
yes.
I really need to play that game again.
I do, too. I have both of them if you want to borrow one.
Yes, I would love to borrow the first one. Okay.
Yeah, but no, I'm 100% with you. I loved the original. It was so good.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, the genie in that, cool playable character. And the evil genie in that, cool evil genie.
Yeah.
Lots of cool evil genie stuff. Man, what's some other? I mean, there's got to be some other genie video games out there.
Oh, I don't know. There's didn't one just come out recently? Yeah, Shantae.
Yeah, with its huge Kickstarter to bring back a GBA game.
Yes, and you know what? I'm damn glad they did.
Oh man, like the only problem I have with Shantae is just it's so fan servicey. Like it's so fan servicey.
It is. I have trouble playing it when the rest of the family's up and about, but. You know I'm of a subculture that has very little shame anyway. Yeah. So
I just man the jiggle physics in that game are just stupid.
Yeah. Like a while back a friend bought me the second one or third one maybe I don't know. Anyway, it was one of the more recent ones and it's really good, but boy it's jiggly.
Yeah.
And then they also bought me, you know, the new one, Half Genie Hero, and I need to play that, but it looks really jiggly.
It is.
And you know what? I'm okay with this, however.
Man. But, yeah, I mean, like, the art is really nice. The gameplay is good. And, yeah, like, I love the background art. The background art's great in it.
The background art's gorgeous. Yeah. The music is gorgeous. It's actually a really funny game.
Yeah, I mean, they like, the people who make it really obviously do care about the game and do obviously have a lot of fun with it.
They do.
Yeah.
And for as fan service as it is, they don't go overboard.
Yeah.
I gotta give them that. They show some restraint. That's more than I can say for some.
Yeah. It's no Neptunia.
It's no Neptunia.
And then, of course, we've got D&D Genies.
Of course.
Of course, being the originator of wish spells, every GM's favorite thing in the world.
Oh, boy.
And the whole monkey's paw relationship that genies have to other things being the main inspiration for why you should not cast the wish spell.
Yep.
D&D does take the extra step to kind of give elemental affiliation to their genies.
Yes. And not just one element either.
Yeah. All four. It kind of, you know, takes them and splits them into, four different, you know, elements. You have the Jinn, which are air associated.
Yes.
The Dao, which are earth associated. The Ifrit, which are fire associated. And the Marids, which are water associated. 5e, or I guess, well, yeah, technically 5e, but like earlier editions also have a fifth type known as Jan, who draw their existence from all four elements, and a sixth type, Karash, which are linked to the pseudo element of cold, which is kind of weird, because, I mean, usually fucking ice and water magic are like hand in hand because D&D is lazy.
Yeah. I always like to do like ice magic as a mixture of air and water.
Yeah. Very, and Naruto does the same thing. It's a somewhat common practice.
I used to have like an actual grid that I'd worked out that I liked rather a lot.
They're usually kind of powerful. They're more like kind of put in things for social encounters. It's very rare to like solely put a djinn in for combat reasons.
Because usually it'll kick the party's ass.
Yeah, well, I mean, it has wish right off the bat.
Yeah. Although, can it cast wish for itself?
Yes.
Wow.
Usually they're put in circumstances where they are contracted to someone else.
Okay.
And the wish spell is usually off limits because of that.
All right.
The wish is usually, like, kind of tied up in the contract to give it magical power.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
I mean, but a ring of wish literally summons a genie.
It's terrifying.
Yes, very. But kind of pushing more of this, like, four-element kind of thing, if you've ever played Golden Sun. Golden Sun has basically little, like, fairy sprite creatures called genie in it.
All right.
They're elementally associated with them, and you collect them and equip them to their character to give you elemental power. They can help you cast magic. You can use them to summon things. They boost your stats, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, that's neat.
Yeah. They're a good, good, fun time. They're very cute. And they almost kind of seem like, fairy or familiar adjacent things to djinn or genies or genie or whatever.
Yeah.
Just kind of like, you know, a wizard would have a cat familiar, a djinn wizard would have a djinnie familiar.
Right. I like that.
Yeah.
And they are absolutely adorable.
Yeah.
Even the Geiger Bunny is adorable.
Yes, the Geiger Bunny. Good old Win Ginny. But because genies have gotten such a strong split elemental focus over the course of them being around,
yeah.
Be it, you know, from their original, like, kind of link to fire and just kind of branching out from that, like, oh, well, if there's fire linked ones, then why not everything else?
yeah.
Yeah. That you have, you know, in our good old friend Planescape, well, who are we going to have be the plane touch their element associated?
Well, I guess we could genies.
Yeah, and technically they're not directly related to genies.
Okay.
They don't really have anything to do with djinn or genies or djinn or Dao or Marids or anything like that in the actual D&D setting, but they are called genasi.
Huh. That's a little on the nose, don't you think?
Yes. There is a heavy and I mean, you know, they're all element focused. There is no kind of wish-granting kind of thing, but in depicted art, you know, I mean, if the air genasi isn't supposed to look like the classical Disney conception of a genie, then I don't know what does.
Yeah, you're right.
But yeah, genasi are...
Do you think Robin Williams played an air genasi?
No, I think Robin Williams play. Oh, wait. Oh, I forgot he does play D&D.
Yeah.
Oh, man. I don't know. He strikes me more as the half-orc bard kind of guy.
He kind of does.
But yeah. His soul. Genasi are, they are basically sentient humanoids that have been irrevocably touched by the elemental plane that they reside in.
Hmm.
So you have fire genasi, air genasi, water genasi, and, Earth Genasi.
Yes.
They're considered plane touched in third edition. Generally, the big thing is that they have a kind of a stat block that's kind of linked to each other that's similar, and then they each have some spell-like abilities and different skill or attribute associations, which kind of make them more thematic to their element.
All right.
So, you know... Air genasi can always float slightly off the ground. They can hold their breath indefinitely. They can sometimes make things levitate. Water genasi can breathe underwater. They have a swim speed. Fire genasi can can always kind of shed light on stuff. If they deal fire attacks, they can make them kind of gout to more damage.
Okay.
You know, little things like that. Earth genasi can are very defensive, resilient, stubborn.
They're basically big dwarves.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. And when fourth edition rolled around, they switched out air for storm genasi. Just because things, in addition to having out of combat stuff, they all got, like, you know, a little bit of a combat focus. Air wasn't an element that they were super focusing on in fourth. Lightning and thunder were, so they became storm genasi.
Especially thunder.
Yeah, thunder and lightning were big deals.
Yes.
Water got an extra focus on cold, and earth and fire basically stayed the same.
Yeah, there wasn't really much of an earth thing at all.
The earth thing is thematically, they had a lot of cool stuff they could do. They usually dealt with difficult terrain, and if they dealt a special damage type, it was thunder.
Yeah.
Which was
weird.
It was the typical thing. It was the loud things crash and sound and reverberation and earthquakes and that kind of stuff.
Like, I get it, but, like, if you're doing four different elements, you don't make them share.
Well, because the Stormblood really didn't use thunder. It was just lightning and, like, pushed movement and that kind of stuff. Yeah. But they also added Abyssal Genasi.
Which are really cool.
Which is basically the Elemental Chaos also had the... In 4th edition, they changed the cosmology wheel a lot.
They did.
Whereas in 3rd and 2nd edition, you have this very rigid Platonic ideal like inspired cosmological wheel.
Yes.
And instead, in 4th edition, you have this weird space soup.
space suit.
Where you have the prime material plane and the planet that you're on.
Yes.
And then parallel to that, you have the Shadowfell and the Feywild. They all occupy the same space.
Yes.
But if you head off from the planet that you're on into the planar space.
The ether!
You have the celestial astral side, and then you have the abyssal elemental side.
Yes.
So the astral sea has the lawful aligned stuff, which does include the nine hells.
Yes.
And then the elemental chaos has the more chaotic and elemental tied stuff instead of the radiant and necrotic tied stuff. So part of that was the abyss. So if you were an elemental plane that got corrupted by the abyss, you'd become an abyssal genasi.
Yes.
Which had what the cinder soul, the plague soul,
the caustic soul, and the void soul.
Yes.
Which all of those appeal to the very, very small edgelord part of me that I occasionally feed on stuff like this.
Yeah. I mean, they were really cool.
They are. I like them.
Yeah. And in addition to that, to give you a little bit more, fun, cool, mechanical stuff, fourth edition had this whole thing called when you had your Paragon tier.
Yes.
Basically, you would choose a class for the first 10 levels, and then when you got from levels 11 to 20, you would pick a Paragon path.
Yes.
Usually this was a branch associated with your class.
Yes.
If you were a paladin, you might take a paragon path that focused on being a defender, or a paragon path that focused on, smiting evil with your righteous powers, or etc.
Yeah.
But you always had other options that were open to you. You had the big one at first was racial paragon paths.
Yes.
Where you might be a fighter, but when you get to level 11, instead of taking a fighter paragon path, well, I'm a human. I'm going to take the human paragon path. And everything involving with that, instead of really relating back to your class, kind of goes into all the ideals of who your race is. So, for humans, it really goes into adaptability and having things that you can kind of declare on the fly and all that kind of stuff.
For like Dragonborn.
Yeah.
Yeah, you could get wings.
Yeah, you could get wings. Your breath power gets better. You get other cool dragon stuff. I can't off the top of my head remember any of the other paragon paths.
That's because they weren't interesting.
That's
a lie, but I'm just saying it because I like Dragonborn.
Yeah, I also, the big thing was, and I don't know how true this is for other people who played a lot of 4th edition, but I know it's true for a lot of people that I've played games with. I ran one Paragon tier game in my entire life. And we had to start in Paragon tier. We didn't get to Paragon tier naturally. And it lasted about 3 sessions before the game fell through, because that's how, fucking tabletop games work.
Yeah. No, I never played one, ever.
Yeah.
Ever.
Yeah, I remember the idea of us eventually playing one with characters after a time skip. And so I had taken my old character and made him into a Paragon path. But that's neither here nor there. So the Genasi one was really cool because its whole thing, it was called Elemental Tempest. Is that correct?
Yes, that is, in fact.
Where it's basically you could take feats to gain multiple elemental souls, as they were called.
Yes.
So, you could be an air genasi and or you could be a storm genasi and a fire genasi, but you kind of had to, take some time and meditate, kind of reposition your relationship with the elemental planes to change that. So it's not like you could hit somebody with a fire attack one round and then shoot them with lightning the next.
Right.
But if you went down the certain paragon path, it was kind of being the master of your race's elemental affinity, and you could be two elements at the same time. You could have two effects active. You could be both a storm genasi and a fire genasi.
You could Kirby it.
Yeah. You could Kirby 64 it, definitely. Yes. Lots of good fun times. There was a third set of genasi that came out for 4th edition, and I can't remember what they were.
The para element?
No, para elementals were a second edition thing.
Okay.
Or maybe a third edition thing. But that was basically Kind of like the whole ice genocide thing, mm-hmm. or ice genies. Basically, taking ideas that weren't considered the four classical elements and making genasi out of them.
Right.
So you had like an ice one, an ooze or a mud one.
There was magma and dust.
Yeah. Which are things we see in Mephits in 5th edition.
Yes.
Because
they're the combinations of two different.
Yeah.
Which I like a lot.
Yes. Oh, they're great. But we never... God, I swear to God that there was... I'm thinking of when Dark Sun came out for 4th edition.
Okay.
And they made a custom genocide for that to fit the setting. So you had Sun Soul, Magma Soul, Sand Soul, and Ember Soul.
Okay.
So they're all fire themed.
Which, that harkens back.
Yeah, but just very slightly differed and with, you know, different takes on how they work in the setting and that kind of thing.
That's so, very cool.
Yeah, a cool little addition. But just how, you know, how we really liked tieflings as kind of weird planar touched beings for Planescape and Spelljammer. Genocide are that.
Yes.
Like, they're that to a T.
And I love it.
Yeah, they're all about taking, like, this elemental idea and hugely, hugely telegraphing it. And, you know, you don't necessarily, if you're playing a fire genocide, you don't necessarily have to play up, you know, being a brash character who has a fiery spirit.
Yeah.
But having that kind of, you know, as a backdrop and how you want to play your character, you know, the smoldering fire genocide that just kind of likes to sit in the corner and really be perceptive is that much better with the idea that most genocide most fire genocide being the fiery brash types, you know, it gives you, it invites you to be a little bit more open and flamboyant and theatrical with the way you're playing your character.
Yeah.
Which really makes it easier to get your character across at a table in a 3-hour setting.
Yes. Ooh, another possible example for a fire one, you know, the warm, open, like, heartwarming, motherly kind of thing.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah. The hearth genocide.
Yeah, there we go.
Yeah. But these, you know, of course, Princes of the Apocalypse came out for 5th edition.
Yes.
One of the races included with it for the player's companion was genocide. Why would you put out an elemental-themed book without genocide in it?
You wouldn't, but I wouldn't be surprised either.
While they are considered rare, there is a major genocide NPC for each element in Prince of the Apocalypse. You guys are just now hitting the point where you start we start running into them like at the second act of the game.
Gotcha. I like 3rd edition's art for genocide.
I don't know what I like better, 3rd or 4th. 3rd is good, but, like, 4th is just, I don't know, I always love 4th.
Like, 5th is very, you know, normal.
I like 5ths, too.
Yeah.
5th kind of solves the problem of certain races looking too fantastical for certain settings.
Yeah.
Like, 4th edition genocide, they look like a Spelljammer race.
They do, and I love every second of it.
I mean, it's guys with, like, ice and fire and lightning shooting out his hair, and, like, they're...
Oh, my God.
They look perfect with a pirate sword and a gun in their hand.
Because they are. They're people with elemental affinity.
Yeah.
Whereas in 3rd edition art, they are basically elementals.
Yeah, they're humanoid elementals, almost.
And then in 5th edition, they're people with funny colored skin, some cool tattoos... And I'm okay with that.
Yeah. And, I know, like, I'm always into high fantasy stuff, but there are so many situations where, like, especially in 4th edition, I would routinely tell people, I just can't run a game if you want to play a Shard Mind. Unless we're running a very, very, very specific type of game, which you all told me you didn't want to play.
Yeah.
I just can't fit Shard Mind into this, because they're crystalline people that are completely inhuman, and they only speak through telepathy, and that's just a lot of shit to deal with in a Tolkien fantasy romp.
Yeah.
But the 5th edition take on genocide are a nice kind of compromise to that kind of thing.
They are.
Where they're a fun, weird fantasy race, but, you know, they work in a subdued, you know, fantasy setting.
You could make them fit in just about anywhere.
Yeah.
Like, as odd as it would be, I could picture them in, you know, walking towards Mordor or whatever. Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of like with tieflings. If you're really going to play up, like, the fangs and the horns and the glowing eyes and the tail and stuff, maybe they don't really fit in like, a classic traditional fantasy game.
You couldn't fit it in Conan.
Yeah. But, I mean, there's enough description of different tieflings that, you know, oh, well, some short horns, and yeah. Maybe they've got, like, one long incisor, or maybe their skin's a little bit funny colored. Maybe they just have, like, some small little bits. And then they start to, they still stick out, because you want them to stick out. But they start to fit in and mesh with other elements a little bit better.
Yeah, like, you know, for a lower tier for the tieflings, you could do, you know, little horn nubbins and longer nails like claws.
Yeah.
And slightly ruddy-ish skin.
Yeah. Whereas if you're playing in a Spelljammer game and you're not a tiefling with giant horns and a tail, or you're not a genocide that has, like, rocky pimples, they get a pimple and it's a little, like, literal, like, quartz crystal coming out of their rock skin or whatever.
Yep.
If you're just playing a regular human or dwarf in that game,
why?
It's like you took a vanilla mayonnaise boy and put them in this wonderful fruit salad.
Yep. God, I've seen it done too. Not the characters, but literal vanilla, like, mayonnaise type stuff in fruit salad. I'm like, nope.
Please do not put mayonnaise in a fruit salad. Just don't.
Thanks. This has been a PSA from your friends here at Creature Culture.
Yeah.
One thing that I really do like about Genocide is their craftsmanship. Everything they do is supposed to be flamboyant.
Yeah.
Like, it's supposed to be, like, extreme. They're supposed to show off what they are and who they are and their element and everything, to the point where craftsmen for the Genasai are very much, all right, I know I'm not as good as this dwarf, okay? I can't make you a masterwork shield of +7 fortitude. However, I can make you a shield that's fit perfectly to you, and it would be the most comfortable thing you'll ever wield, and it will look exactly the way you want it, and it's perfect. Just not quite as good as that guy's.
Yeah, I mean, it's something about 5e's art that I wish they brought more from 4e, where, like, you know, they go out of their way to make sure that Genasi, I fucking go back and forth on it all the time.
Everyone pronounces it the same damn way, so you're good.
They go out of their way to make sure that they look like they come from a culture.
Yes.
The different characters are, like, their clothing and craftsmanship is, like, consistent. It looks like, you know, they're from a community where everyone has certain, you know, kind of ideas about style and fashion, and they use certain materials and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which is a thing that anyone listening to the show knows that I'm a big nerd for.
Yes.
And 4th edition always did such a good job of that, even in situations where I thought it looked dumb, like tiefling and dragonborn art.
Yes.
But, I mean, even, you know, dwarves in that, everything they had was, like, super geometric and looked chaste and worked and that kind of stuff. And you just don't see that in 5th edition's art. You know, the dwarves are kind of, they're dwarfy, but, you know, you got the one key dwarf guy that shows up a lot in the player's handbook, and he's always in armor, but that's because he's a armor dwarf or whatever.
And yeah, that's definitely a thing. Fifth edition art doesn't have the same consistency. It's good art, but it's not as consistent as 4th edition was, even accepting that 4th edition was wildly flamboyant about most things.
Yeah. I guess the big difference is 4th edition's art was about trying to give you a tone for the different races and the different classes and that kind of thing.
Right.
Whereas 5th edition is mostly concerned with the kind of through thread that, like, Pathfinder and 3rd edition D&D had, where we're showing you characters. We're showing you kind of people that will be in stories that you're going to play out.
Yes.
That aren't necessarily representative of the races as a whole, which is fine, and I get that. And definitely you want to make people feel like they can play characters that don't fit into the box that the race describes.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, there's not a lot about 5th edition's player's handbook that really describes a setting that isn't Tolkienic. And that was a nice thing about 4th edition setting, is the beauty of those books, of those core books, is that just by reading them without there being a setting included with it, it helped you internalize a setting to play in.
That's the thing. It made you want to make your own stuff.
Yeah.
And given that was the only option, really, that was something that was great.
But like, you know, yeah, you had to kind of homebrew the logistics of where the kingdoms lie and stuff. But just by reading and looking at that art, you already have the idea that they want you to play.
Yes.
That Dragonborn are like this. They're honorable, and they're slightly nomadic, and they have these weapons.
Yes.
And then elves are like this.
Exactly. It's a silly way to put it, but I feel like 5th edition art feels like it was done by all humans. 4th edition felt like it was done by the genocide.
Yes.
Honestly.
You just have a genocide art committee, and they're like, oh, dwarves, yeah, like, everything's square, right? Yeah, sure.
And 3rd edition feels a bit like elves.
Let's not talk about 3rd edition art. let's talk about Pathfinder art. Pathfinder art's a lot better.
Pathfinder art was all done by goblins, and I will say nothing more.
It's so good, though.
Sure. Now, there are definitely elements I do like of it.
Yeah.
Like one of my DM screens, it's the same folks who did the Pathfinder art for 4th edition.
Yeah.
And it's real good.
Yeah.
That's one thing I wanted to bring up about 4th edition that I loved. It's all action lines.
Yeah.
It's very much in motion. You can see action scenes in literally everything.
Yeah, I guess probably one of the bigger differences between 4th edition and 5th edition's art is 4th edition also had very high contrast art, whereas 5th edition, it's much more muted. And I guess that's to make things kind of lay on the page a little bit better and read a little bit better.
Yeah.
But and the image you're specifically looking at on your iPad now isn't a super great example, but like think to the 4th edition Player's Handbook 1 cover.
Yes.
And just how much heavy like light and dark values are on that page.
Oh, yeah.
And how everything just pops out of it.
It absolutely does. It's a 3D image you don't have to have 3D for.
Yeah.
But no, it's absolutely gorgeous. And I love the idea of genocide, especially because they're so colorful.
Yeah.
Because they're such wildly different colors and ideas, it just contrasts and meshes so well.
Yeah.
And that's one thing I don't think I've ever really expressed on this podcast before, but my big aesthetic preference is for wildly varying different colors all coming together.
Yeah. The last thing that I want is if I have to deal with another brown video game, I don't want that brought into my headspace while I'm imagining a tabletop game.
Absolutely not. I will not stand for it.
Yeah.
No. It's just not going to happen. It has to be varied and different. And all things considered, that's what genocide are.
Yeah.
And that's why I like them so much.
I just, oh man, just give me more plain touched. I need them in my life.
Please do. I love the base, you know, physical realms or whatever. That's great. They're great. Give me something more.
Yeah. Give me that. Just bring back Planescape. Bring back Spelljammer. Just do it. Just please.
Spelljammer.
Do it soon.
Oh. I'm so excited.
It probably won't happen for like another 5 years, but still, I want it to happen.
I'm still hype.
Yeah.
But all things taken together, that's djinn and genocide.
Yeah. That's genies, that's djinn, that's genocide.
That's a lot of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, we've done episodes like this before.
We have.
The Triad Plant People episode.
Oh, yeah, that was good, though.
Yeah.
I like that one. I like this one.
Yeah. Please get in contact with us. Creature Cultura at Twitter, Pagetish at Twitter, Nullbard at Twitter.
Yep.
Creatureculture.tumblr.com. Our ask box is always open.
Yep.
Anonymous is on too, so you don't have to feel pressured if you don't want us to know who you are or whatever.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
It's no big deal.
Yeah, please. I mean, you know, if we did say at the beginning of the show we're going to be wrapping the show up. Yes. It's not going to be for a while. Right now, if we do five or six more episodes, then
still
that's
have 3 months.
3 more months.
Yeah.
We'd be wrapping up in October again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know what? All things considered, that's a good time.
Yeah. I mean, if we go to November too, that's fine.
Yeah.
Please, if you have any, if you want us to just like talk about anything at the end, any like weird little questions, if you want us to cover a specific race, if there's a setting that you want us to cover that doesn't require us to read 8 novels.
yeah.
We would love to hear from you all. We love you all.
We do.
Yep.
Throw me the ask at nullbard.com. That's a thing.
Yeah. Get at me at twitter.com/PADGETTI. PADGETTISH. Yeah.
There we go.
That's Twitter handle.
we love y'all.
If you were a genasi of a non-4 element, what would you be?
Oh boy.
Be a carbon genasi? plutonium genasi.
Yes.
Be a fart genasi.
Probably a sulfur genasi.
Yeah.
Just bad eggs.
Yeah. I mean, as everyone likes to tell me, if I was a genasi.